Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll learn about the open house at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Center with Bonita Nelson. Sarah Lewis from the Cooperative Extension Service will be here to highlight summer activities. We'll talk with Linda Rosenthal and Reggie Schaff from Juno Jazz and Classics about the upcoming summer string workshops and the Pink Martini concert in September. We'll learn about the Bartlett Foundation Baby Box Program, that, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more on a Juno Afternoon, which is next. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, isolated showers in the evening, and a chance of rain late. Lows around 54. Join us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An effort in Rapid City, South Dakota, is working to improve race relations. The city has seen racial tensions increase in recent months following a police shooting of a Lakota man and an incident where a group of non-natives are accused of shouting racial slurs and throwing beer on Lakota children at a hockey game. The new effort is tied to a group called Community Conversations. It includes a coalition of individuals and organizations working to build relationships across cultures and find new solutions to long-standing divisions. Charles Michael Ray has more.
At a press conference in Rapid City's Memorial Park, leaders of the Native American community stood beside leaders from the Chamber of Commerce, Regional Health, and the Rapid City Police Department, along with a host of other organizations. Scott Means, an educator who is Lakota and Hopi, has lived and worked in Rapid City for 21 years. Means says he's happy to see this new effort take hold following many years of struggle against racism in Rapid City.
We've marched on the city in the past, Lakota people. We've taken up arms. We've been in courts. Today is an evolution from those times. We're moving forward in our lives by asking people to come to the table and let's create something. What? It's up to us as a community.
The board chair of the Chamber of Commerce, Marnie Herman, announced a new chamber resolution supporting diversity, dialogue, and respect. The president of the Rapid City Regional Hospital, Mick Gibbs, expressed hope in creating a new positive future where all cultures are respected and admired. Karen Mortimer with the Rapid City Public Schools Foundation and the Ochete Sakowin Ambassadors says this is just the beginning of the effort as the work to build positive relationships continues. This week in Rapid City, the trial of Trace O'Connell could lead to another spike in racial tension. O'Connell is charged with disorderly conduct after he allegedly threw beer and uttered racial slurs at a group of Lakota children during a hockey game in January. Those with the Community Conversation Group say the new local effort is in part a response to this incident. They say positive outcomes and improved race relations can be found in the long term. I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Mohawk First Nations in Canada recently marched to remember 25 years since the standoff between them and soldiers, which caught worldwide attention. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Dozens of people marched during the July weekend, taking the same path in Kanesatagi they barricaded 25 years ago to protest plans to build a golf course on land they claimed as their own. The crisis began on July 11, 1990, with a shootout in which a Quebec police officer was killed. The army was called in. The crisis was finally resolved peacefully 78 days later. The golf course was not built. But Ellen Gabriel, an activist and a spokeswoman for the Mohawks 25 years ago, says today nothing has changed.
We are still struggling for the same issue. We have lost more land in Ganasavage than we had 25 years ago. And so the struggle is there.
Other Native leaders from the region say no Native land was given up, but the land all around the disputed golf course is again under threat from developers. Joe Norton is the Grand Chief of the nearby Ganawage First Nation. He too says little has changed, especially from Canadian government leaders.
The government is resistant, just dug its heels in, you know, doesn't want to recognize court rulings, doesn't care about those things, you know, and just keeps pushing its agenda. Whatever's going to happen positively for us is that we have to do it on our own.
But the weekend also stirred some strong emotions and memories for those who were present during the crisis 25 years ago. On a more positive note, locally, Native and non-Native leaders say they're working together to fight any development on disputed land. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by United Tribes Technical College, offering courses online for a career in medical coding and for updating your current coding certification. Registration available through August 10th online at uttc.edu. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau afternoon on a Wednesday afternoon. Lori Scandling here with you, and Jeff Brown, our producer, is in the studio as well. Our first guest today is Benita Nelson. She has been a fish biologist for 29 years with the Auk Bay Lab, but she also coordinates some of their outreach programs for the Ted Stevens Marine Research Center, such as Sea Week, and she is here to tell us about an event this Friday that honors Ted Stevens Day, which is actually on Saturday. So what's going on out at that beautiful facility at Lena Point on Friday, Benita? And welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. We are going to have an open house this Friday from 2:30 to 7 p.m., where we will be giving tours every 20 minutes that are going to be led by scientists, and we're going to go into some science labs to see some of our equipment. We are also going to have our touch tank set up that is normally only set up during Sea Week for the school kids who come out for us, but will be set up for the public. We are going to have some partner groups out there to talk with you about their interactions with fisheries research. We're going to have Oceana. We're going to have UAS, UAF, United Fishermen's, Armstrong Keita, ASME. So there'll be about 10 groups that will be out there to give out information and to talk about fisheries research. We'll have some refreshments that will be provided by the Ted Stevens Foundation, who are promoting Ted Stevens Day, which is Saturday. And so we'll also have some videos playing so you can see examples of our research, the boats and the fish we catch and things like that.
That is a beautiful facility out there. It is now 8 years old, and I understand that conducting the open house is every other year, so this is a pretty rare opportunity for the public to wander through the facility and have the opportunity to interact with some of the scientists there.
Yes, that's correct. During the tourist season, like May through September, we do offer tours daily where we have a contract employee who will show people around the building and we'll show them the science on the sphere that we have, like the museum has. But during that tour, we don't go into laboratories. And so this is the only chance the public has to go into laboratories and talk to scientists who are actually doing work in those laboratories.
Tell us a little bit about what someone might see in the laboratories that the Marine Research Center offers.
Well, what we're going to show you is a typical biology lab. You know, we're a fish organization, so we go out and we catch lots of fish and we measure them and weigh them and see what they're eating, you know, and that's the real basis of trying to understand the stocks that we manage, that NOAA Fisheries manage. So we're going to see a typical biology lab. We're going to go up to the chemistry lab, and in our chemistry lab, we have done this will be our final year doing work related to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. We're still going up there. We still found oil last week left over from the spill.
We might mention for folks that have forgotten, that was in 1989.
Yes, it was 26 years ago.
So we're talking 26 years.
So we're still assessing some of those oiled beaches. We're also looking at fish where we're looking at the nutritional health of fish. So we see how much lipid they have and protein, and will juvenile fish live through the winter? We can assess that. And then we're going to go into the genetics lab. And so the genetics lab is, you know, looks at the genetics of fish and where are they from. So, for instance, one of the issues that we're looking at is the Chinook salmon bycatch issue is a big issue where there's a lot of Chinook salmon in the Bering Sea, the Gulf of Alaska, that are being caught by the pollock fishery. And so what we do is we look and see where those fish were from, and we look at to trying to assess how we can have the pollock fishery not catch these Chinook salmon so we don't have to have, you know,
as many quotas and that there'll be enough to go. So we do that with genetics, and then we do them with things called code-aware tags, which are little pieces of tags that shows the markings, they have markings on them to where that fish was actually born. So those are the types of issues we're going to be talking about. Those are the scientists doing the work you'll be able to interact with, and then you'll be able to see some of the equipment that we actually are looking to solve some of these problems.
So let me back up a minute. I'm still stuck on looking at the genetic material to find out where they're from. So is there a little stamp on there that says Sawmill Bay Hatchery? Or
well,
how do you, you mean if you're looking at a picture of genetics, how does that tell you where?
Well, there's two parts. The first part is actually with hatcheries, they put a little metal tag that does have little markings that will say, you know, DIPAC or wherever. And then biologists have gone around to all these salmon streams and they've taken samples of salmon tissues and they've run them in the lab. And then it's kind of a comparing CSI thing where then you get an unknown fish that maybe was out in the Bering Sea or the Gulf of Alaska. And then they match it up to say, oh, this is where they're from.
That's some refined science.
Yeah. And so the people who are actually doing the research will be available to talk to that. We'll have the scientific posters up. You'll see a little some of the equipment that we use. And so
you mentioned the touch tank, and I had assumed that that was something that was always operating at the lab there.
Right.
Tell us about what will be in the touch tank, and do you fold it up and put it away, or
yeah.
what happens when it's not available to the public?
So what we do, and we've done this since Sea Week started in 1969 with parents from the Auk Bay Lab, with other people actually started Sea Week. So, and they thought it was a good idea that we bring some intertidal creatures into the lab and let people see them. And so during May, when we have the kindergartners and sixth graders come out, we have divers go so they can dive a little deeper than the intertidal, but we get all the types of sea stars we have. We have sea cucumbers, we have hermit crabs, we have sometimes scallops and mussels and just a lot of the common things to really let people see what they are. And you would be surprised how many sixth graders I have who do not know what a blue mussel is and where you would find them and the difference between our rocky shores and like Sandy Beach. And I said, well, where would we find these? You know, and they're, and so we do a lot of education with that, but it's really hard on the animals. You know, we put them in the
to
aquarium.
To be handled, you
right.
mean, sure.
Yeah, especially over 3 or 4 weeks. So what we did this time is we had scuba divers go out and get some animals and in the intertidal, and so you'll be able to see the types of intertidal creatures that we have right around Juneau.
So this sounds like a terrific opportunity for families with young children or adolescents or anybody who hasn't been exposed to the kind of animals that are right on our beaches.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the lab, you know, the lab tours will be not so appropriate for young kids, but we will have this touch tank and some other activities for young kids also to do too. But adolescents, yeah, it's really good. And, you know, to know that, you know, the federal government is out there managing our fisheries, so, you know, the fishermen can fish and we can fish, and people don't really realize what that involves. And they'll get a good impression of that, I think, if they come out on Friday.
Let's talk for just a moment about the economic impact on Juneau of having the Marine Research Center here in Juneau. How many folks are employed by the Auk Bay Lab and at the Ted Stevens Center? Can you give us an estimate of that?
Yeah, we have about 70 right now full-time employees. We've had massive retirements like a lot of federal agencies have. And so we have a lot of contract employees and students that work. So there's probably about 100 of us who work there. And we are the largest fisheries research center in Alaska, our building. And we share the campus with UAF, University of Alaska Fairbanks Fisheries, School of Ocean and Fisheries Science. And we do a lot of collaboration out there. So I would say on the campus, there's probably 200 of us working there.
That's a substantial investment in our community as well. We mentioned students. You just said you have students working out there, and before we went on the air, we talked about some of the impact of children at the upper elementary level being able to go out and explore our beaches during Sea Week, which, if we were to be honest, is more like a sea month, really,
yes,
typically in May.
It's sea month, yes.
And you mentioned it started in 1969, which I didn't know, so it's been 46 years, if my math is correct, and that's
right.
A couple generations. Have you seen some young kids, yes, who was little guys were out on the beach who are now maybe working at the facility.
Yes, we have two employees who are working at the facilities because they came in Sea Week, and they fell in love with it then, and they are back. We're seeing people who are now having children and bringing their children there who came as kids. And, of course, some of the same people still work there. It's like, oh, I remember this person or something like that, you know. But we also have a lot of people who come at Sea Week in sixth grade and then they come back in high school and maybe do a science fair or a job shadow thing and then want to see if they could work with us in an internship or maybe after college, deciding what they want to do or ultimately get a job there. And so there's four or five people right now who work out there who started, I got to know them when they were maybe freshmen and sophomores through science fair, and they just keep wanting to do it. So we can offer kids the opportunity to really do some hands-on science out there. Also.
How exciting. Well, we've been visiting with Benita Nelson. She's a fish biologist who has been with the Auk Bay Lab as part of the Ted Science Marine Research Center for 29 years. She's done a lot of education and outreach for the center, and we're talking about the open house this Friday, 2:30 to 7, for the Ted Stevens Day. Ted Stevens Day is actually Saturday, but the event is being held on a work day so that visitors have a chance to see the actual operation of the lab. Thanks for sharing that with us, Benita.
Well, thank you very much.
Fishes swim as the waves roll in and the waves roll out. The waves roll in and the waves roll out. The fishes swim as the waves roll in.
And welcome back to a Juneau Afternoon. With us is Sarah Lewis from the Cooperative Extension Service. We're going to talk about summer activities with an emphasis on pressure canning. And Jeff Brown, our producer, asked a great question before we came back on the mic, and that is, kind of analyze, how's this year for berries? I see people all over the roadway and in the
one
woods.
One word, awesome. It's been a great year for berries. It was an early year, which surprised a lot of people, but we're ready. We were ready, even though it was early. So, yeah, lots of berries, lots of jams and jellies being made, lots of canning of berries. It's been great. I've been teaching classes on that as well.
Sarah, I'm not sure people know what the history of the Extension Service is. It has kind of a funny name.
It does.
Well, tell us about the, no pun intended, the roots of the Extension Service and why we have one of those.
Terrific. So we are actually the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service Juneau District. That's the office that I'm in. So we just like to call ourselves Extension. And what the Extension is every land-grant university in the country for the past 100 years has had an Extension program associated with it. So our land-grant university is in Fairbanks. And we are basically the community education arm of the university system, with the goal of both bringing university and research-based information to the public, as well as finding out what the public wants to learn about and bringing that back to the university so that the halls of education can remain relevant to people.
And land grant means that the state gave the land for the construction of the college. Every state has one. It seems like much of what the Cooperative Extension focuses on are practical, hands-on activities and information. So tell us a little bit about what's going on this summer.
Sure. So my program is the Family and Community Development Program. So many people are familiar with the Agriculture and Horticulture Program and the 4-H program because of Master Gardeners and the 4-H Youth Program. My program in family and community development focuses on pretty much everything except for agriculture, horticulture, and 4-H, though of course I do things with youth as well, but food-related, so food preservation, food safety, food preparation, home economics, home energy, general home resource use, finances. We also in my program branch out about a bit into economic development, and I focus mostly on food entrepreneurs. So I assist people, and we have folks up in Fairbanks who are specialists as well, helping people start small food-related businesses. Because one of my big focuses here in Southeast, because I am the agent in my program for all of Southeast. We have two districts. We have Juneau and Sitka, but I'm the agent for both districts. So I was actually just in Sitka last week, teaching a bunch of classes, and in over the next couple of months, I'll be heading to several other places, Petersburg, Prince of Wales, Skagway, and Haines, I think, are on my list for the next couple of months. And so I teach these classes throughout Southeast, and mostly, probably 80% or more of the classes I teach are on food preservation. And because
very appropriate for this region. Absolutely.
We have an amazing natural harvest. Wild harvest, gardening, but wild harvest does tend to be, of course, seasonal. And if you want to enjoy whatever that harvest is, fish, venison, berries, for the year, you need to preserve it. And so one of the main ways that we actually do that in most of Alaska, but definitely in Southeast, is through canning.
So I'm wondering, as I listen to you, I reflect on the eons of food preservation by indigenous original peoples in this region.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if those are methods that you incorporate in your teaching. And tell us about that.
There are some. There are some that are actually not just looks Alaska indigenous, but worldwide. So fermentation, for example, is something that every culture around the world, fermentation tended to be or was the first food preservation method that people did to try to extend whatever their harvest was. Sauerkraut is one of the ones that everybody knows about, sauerkraut. Lutefisk. So different cultures, kimchi. Different cultures developed different fermentation processes and what foods they fermented, and those can be very local and very, and here in Southeast, you often hear about stink eggs and stink heads. Those are fermented fish products. And so those are very connected to indigenous and local cultures. And so I actually do teach a class on fermentation. I don't teach a class on fermenting fish or meats particularly, though I do a little bit of pickling fish, but that's more vinegar and lemon acid pickling. But so I do a class on fermentation of vegetables, for example. And also dehydrating.
Let's talk a little bit about the pressure cooking. You can buy at any grocery store or variety store the jars and lids that you need. What should someone keep in mind when they're thinking about making a jam or otherwise conducting pressure cooking to preserve food?
Sure. So high acid foods like berries and fruits, they need to be water bath canned. So they only need to be canned in boiling water because they're high acid. So you're only concerned about if they mold or if they ferment in the jar. You're not worried about with berries and such. You're not worried about botulism with those. Where you start to worry about botulism is when you are canning meat and vegetables. Those are low acid foods, fish, meat, and vegetables. Vegetables that haven't been turned into pickles are a low acid food. And so we do a lot of that here because salmon and deer, and we're of course in the middle of our salmon season, and we're coming right up on our deer hunting season. So this is the time that I really like to talk about the necessity of having a pressure canner if you're going to be canning fish or deer. And you can buy a pressure canner. I think they have them at Walmart here. They have them at Western Auto. They have them at Western Auto. And you can, of course, purchase them online as well. You need to get a pressure canner, not a pressure cooker, if you're going to be canning your fish and your deer. The difference, you can give me a call with probably a little more detail here, but you want to be canning them in a pressure canner so that you know that the temperatures are getting high enough to kill the potential botulism that might be in the product.
What would be the benefit of canning over, say, having something smoked or flash frozen?
Well, there are different nutritional and energy and the ease of doing it. So we kind of look at those three. How difficult is it? How nutritious does the food remain or lose nutrition? And the energy and the cost of it. So pressure canning is sort of intermediate when it comes to difficulty, although some people are a little bit afraid of it because they haven't done it before. Once you learn the process and you have the equipment, it's actually very easy. I shouldn't tell people that. You need to come to my classes. It's very important. But it's actually, once you know the processes, it's not difficult. And it's not dissimilar to when you're cooking a food in terms of whether it loses nutrition. So it's sort of intermediate in those. But it's very cost effective because you don't have to keep paying for the energy like you do with a freezer. And one thing that's really great about canning fish or deer is, let's say one season you fill your freezer, you're eating it over the course of the year, but you still have several pounds left, but you're getting ready to head on back out to either go fishing or hunting. You can then take those out of the freezer and can those up and put them on the shelf. And so you've got several more years of storage of that particular food, and then you can refill your freezer.
What is the expected shelf life of a can? I am thinking of the K rations in World War II, and you could probably pop one open now. But what is advisable?
For best quality, 1 year, but that's quality. For safety, a long, long time, as long as they were canned properly and they stay sealed.
And that means no air, essentially.
That means no air. Right,
with,
right.
Potential bacteria could get inside of there.
Correct.
If someone wanted more information, Sarah, either about the canning process or how to contact you for information about the classes, or they had a question about a particular detail, what's the best way for interested folks to contact you? Or maybe you have some website recommendations.
Sure. Well, calling us is always great. 523-3280, extension 0 will get you to Susie. And I do pressure canner gauge testing. So if you have a pressure canner that has a dial gauge, it needs to be tested once a year. I do that for free right in the office, but it's a good idea to call beforehand. This year I won't be able to do that until after August 19th, but give us a call because I do want people to get their gauges tested. We're on Facebook. You can just look up Juno Extension on Facebook. You can Google Juno Cooperative Extension, uaf.edu/CES, and then you click the Juno button is our main website.
So I want to repeat some of that information. One of the things you said is, come on by. Where is on by?
There you go.
We are.
Some people will be surprised at the new location, though we have been there a year. We are at 450 Whittier. It's the public safety building.
You're right across the
street. Right across the street. We're right across the street from K2 and the museum construction site. And we're right on the main floor. If you come in the front door on the first floor, you just look straight back and you come right back to our office. And Susie is there from 8 to 5, except sometimes for lunch.
What else is going on with Cooperative Extension this summer? Are there any other programs you'd like to highlight while you're here?
Well, we're kind of, in a way, heading towards the end because we have our 4-H camp, which happens near the beginning of summer, and that was very successful. 4-H is going to have some continuing programs for youth in middle school and high school, so contact the office about those. There's going to be some outdoor adventure camps, Chautauqua Camp. That was inspired by the new old-time Chautauqua that came to town, so that's going to be a lot of fun. We've got a lot of really creative kids in 4-H, and we always want more. We've got a sailing club that is just winding up its summer sailing season, but will start into its winter adventure planning season here pretty soon, and there'll be spaces for kids in middle school and high school in that. Look for the community schools bulletin that will come out because I always have a series of classes that I teach on food preservation. I think this year I'm going to be doing something called Preserving the Holidays. You'll be learning all of the food preservation methods, but we'll have a focus on maybe gifts and holiday meals and things like that. I am teaching a lot outside of Juneau as well, like I said, throughout Southeast. So just go to our website and see where we're going to be.
Very good. Well, thank you, Sarah. We appreciate your stopping by and talking about the Cooperative Extension Service. It is an arm, the public education arm of the UAF. And here's the magic number to call for all information you might need, 523-3280. That's 523-3280 at Extension 80.
Extension 0.
Extension 0. Thank you. Or you can go online at uaf.edu. CES for Cooperative Extension Service, or drop by their office at 450 Whittier Street. Sarah, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 22nd of July, 2015. Shakespeare's play The Merchant of Venice was entered on the Stationer's Register on this day in 1598. It probably had been written around 1596. It had already been performed several times. It was very popular in the court of King James I. It was the play in which Shakespeare coined some words that we still use today, the word laughable, scrubbed, compromise, and he gave us the phrases bated breath, love is blind, and all that glitters is not gold. It's the birthday of the biochemist Salmon Abraham Waxman, who discovered streptomycin, first effective treatment of tuberculosis, born in Ukraine, 1888. It's the birthday of the man who said, all I ever wanted to do was to paint sunlight on the side of a house, the painter Edward Hopper, born in Nyack, New York, 1882. He was 6 feet tall by the time he was 12. He was skinny, gangly boy, made fun of by his classmates, painfully shy, spent much of his time alone, drawing, went to art school, took a trip to Paris, spent almost all of his time there alone, reading or painting, and there in Paris realized he had fallen in love with light. Came back to New York. He worked as an illustrator at an ad agency, which he hated, but in his spare time he drove around and painted train stations and gas stations and corner saloons. His reputation was made at the Museum of Modern Art. He had a solo show in 1933 that made him famous. Paintings with titles like Houses by the Railroad, Manhattan Bridge Loop, Room in Brooklyn, Roofs of Washington Square, Cold Storage Plant, Lonely House, and Girl on Bridge. It's the birthday of Emma Lazarus, born New York City, 1849, to a wealthy Jewish family. She worked among the poor, the refugees, organized relief efforts for immigrant Jewish families, and when the Statue of Liberty Committee approached her in 1883, asked her to write a poem that they could auction off to raise money for the monument, she wrote them, the poem The New Colossus, including the famous lines, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And it was on this day in 1587, English settlers arrived at Roanoke Island off the coast of North Carolina. It was the third group of English to arrive in this country and the first to include women and children. It was intended to be a permanent settlement. The governor, John White, planned to build up a self-sustaining economy. He sailed back to England 4 months later, did not return to Roanoke Island for nearly 3 years, and then he found the settlement deserted, all the buildings taken down, the word Croatoan carved into a fence post. It is still not known for sure what caused the settlers to leave, but there were no signs of sickness or violence. Here's a poem for today by Theodore Rethke, entitled Snake. I saw a young snake glide out of the mottled shade and hang limp on a stone, a thin mouth and a tongue stayed in the still air. It turned, it drew away, its shadow bent in half, it quickened and was gone. I felt my slow blood warm. I longed to be that thing, the pure, sensuous form, and I may be sometime. Theodore Rethke's poem Snake, from the collected poems of Theodore Rethke, published by Anchor Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org, and by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau. July swim schedules are now available online at juneau.org/parkrec. Augustus Brown Pool is also offering swim lessons on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings during the summer season. More information at 586-5325.
And we're back in the studio for Juneau Afternoon. Lori Scandling and Jeff Brown with you. Our guests right now are Linda Rosenthal, a 40-year Alaska resident, and as many listeners know, a world-renowned violinist, who is about to receive the Mayor's Lifetime Achievement Award from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council here in Juneau. That will be bestowed upon her on August 21st, 5 o'clock, at the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. Congratulations, Linda. Much deserved. And Reggie Schapp, who is the administrator of the Juneau Jazz and Classics program, which is entering its 30th season. We are talking about the Summer Strings Workshop coming up. Tell us the basics. When and who and their instrument are invited? I did ask about my banjo, and I think we realized we probably need to clarify what sort of instruments with strings you're thinking about.
Yes. I'm glad we discussed that before. You said, is it for all string players? And, of course, I said yes, thinking about violins, violas, cellos, and double basses. So those are the instruments we're targeting at this string workshop.
And will you be teaching it, Linda?
I will not. Unfortunately, I will not even be here because I happen to run a workshop in upstate New York at that very time every year. But we have two wonderful teachers, musicians, artists from Seattle. One of them is familiar to the young string players in Juneau, and her name is Tracy Helming, violinist, extraordinary teacher, and so inspiring to the kids, you know, so encouraging. And she is bringing a colleague, Rajan Krishnaswamy, from Seattle also. They work together, and he too, I know from reputation, is just equally wonderful as a teacher, as a cellist, and in encouraging young kids to just, you know, get better, love what they're doing, and just a totally upbeat teacher.
Does the workshop target youth, or
yes,
is it for everyone?
It does. We are targeting youth, and we're suggesting ages 10 and older for this workshop.
Where and what are the dates?
The dates are August 12th through the 14th, so it's a three-day workshop, and it's at UAS. It's on campus in the Egan Classroom Wing. The cost is $125, and I'd like to also mention that we are offering scholarships through our Jane and Tom Stewart Education Fund, and thanks to many generous individuals and businesses. And did I give the time from, I don't think I did. It's kind of like a type of camp, really. I mean, that's how we've fashioned it. It's not a camp, but we're treating it. It's a camp-like experience for the kids. It goes from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. all 3 days. And the kids will be doing a variety of, activities from ensemble playing to group lessons to master classes, and the teachers will just have them busy all the time, and even when they're not playing music, like during their lunch break, they'll be doing really fun activities. And
will there be a culminating performance?
Yes,
by chance?
There will. Yes.
Has that date been set then?
Yes, that will be on the final day on Friday,
the 14th.
The 14th.
Okay. August 14th. Good to know. Yeah. Reggie, you're the administrator of Juneau Jazz and Classics, now beginning its 30th season. And I wondered if the Strings Workshop was a fundraiser, and both of you said, oh, no, this is part of our education and outreach program. Talk about the program and what other opportunities are part of that for your 30th season.
Well, besides the youth one we're doing right now, we will have a cabaret workshop in October that is part of, again, our outreach program. It's going to be for a week in the evenings for anyone involved, There is no age limit one way or the other. And Barney McClure is going to be coming up again and running that cabaret workshop, and it'll be culminating with the performance of our local people on the 16th, on Friday the 16th at the Jack. So that's one of the ones we have. We also have the Laystrin Trio coming, part of the Partners in Performance grant that we received last year. And they're going to be coming up and doing a three-day workshop, again with string instruments, working with different ensembles and school groups, including the jam program here in Juneau. Those will be our two big ones. And then during the festival, of course, we have lots of free performances. All of our artists in residence go to the schools. They go to the senior centers. They go to the hospital. We spread music throughout Juneau for 2 weeks.
It is impressive looking at the three-weekend lineup and the time in between. How many different venues host an appearance of one of the teachers and or performers during Juneau Jazz and Classics? So a couple of string workshops will be happening in the next few months. And Linda, are you sensing that there is an increasing or perhaps a decrease in the interest in stringed instruments? Is there any of that in thinking about being able to offer these workshops for youth?
Oh, I think there's definitely an increase. Yes, there's no question. I mean, this is
so not a worry of a withering of interest.
Not at all. Oh, no, no, no. And this is thanks to so many individuals and the support from, the community. There's the JAM program, which will have, 500 kids in that program coming up this fall. And all the private teachers in town who have many, many students, and the school programs, the middle school has an orchestra, the two high schools have an orchestra. So strings are thriving, at least violins, violas, cellos, and double basses. The string program, I think, in the whole string community is growing, and it's just it's so thrilling to see that. And that's why, we're so excited to offer this. A longer workshop, the 3-day, we're calling it an intensive workshop, but it's really like an immersion. It's a chance for kids to jump in and get all fired up about playing again before the school year, to dust off the instruments if they haven't been playing all summer, and work with two really, really terrific, inspiring teachers.
How many students are you anticipating would sign up for this? Or do you have a limit?
Well, no, we don't really have a limit. I think we're hoping for about 30. And there will be two levels. There will be varying levels, and so we want to encourage kids of, who have had less experience, the more people who might consider themselves beginners, but read notes. We want them to sign up, and of course we want the intermediate and advanced kids to sign up too. Yeah, we'll be able to accommodate many different levels.
We're talking with Linda Rosenthal. She is a longtime artist here in our community and the founder of Juneau Jazz and Classics, and her colleague, Reggie Schapp, who is the administrator of that program. We're talking about a 3-day intensive strings workshop for youth targeting ages 10 and over. That will be held August 12th through the 14th at the UAS campus from 9 to 4 each day. There are scholarships. The price is $125. Reggie, tell the folks where they can register and what's the best way to gain more information or to connect with somebody if they have questions.
Well, we have more information on our website, www.jazzandclassics.org, and there's actually, you can click on the registration form there. If they want other questions answered, they can call the office, which is 463-3378.
I'll repeat that number. It's 463-3378 for questions about the upcoming strings workshop. Thank you both for joining us today. And again, congratulations, Linda, on your award.
Thank you.
Before you go, let's take this opportunity to promote a fantastic concert that's coming up in September and give people kind of a sneak preview so they can save the date.
We actually have two fantastic benefit concerts coming up in September. On September 6th is Three Men and a Baby Grand with Zool Bailey, Ajawan Pratt, and Ben Vereen, and that's going to be at the Jack. And then we also have Pink Martini, the little orchestra that can do anything, with lead singer Storm Large coming on September 20th. Currently, right now, we are only selling tickets to our donors. If you're not a donor, you can become one quite easily by coming to the office or by going online. And tickets will open for Zool Bailey this Friday, July 24th, to the public, and you'll be able to get them online, Hearthside Books and the Jack. But for Peak Martini, they don't go on sale till August 1st, so you've got a little bit more time to wait if you're not a donor.
Well, let's get a taste of Pink Martini, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Lori.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon in our final segment today. Christina Finner, Karen White, and Jason Puckett are joining me. And Christina is with the Bartlett Hospital Foundation. Karen is with Best Beginnings. Is that right? Bartlett Beginnings. I'm mixing it up with Best Beginnings, but you can get a good beginning at Bartlett. And Jason Puckett is with GCI. Christina, why don't you start us off on what is the foundation promoting here in the Baby Box program?
So every year we have a gala, and this year our campaign, our main campaign for the gala, is a Baby Box project with Bartlett Beginnings. The project is based off of a project that they've had in Finland since the 1930s, and it is a box that the state sends home with mothers, or in this case, Bartlett Beginnings, that has all the things that you would need to have a nice, safe, and healthy start for your baby. The box also works as a bed, and it promotes safe sleep and helps prevent SIDS.
That's quite a box. Karen, as the Bartlett Beginnings representative here, tell us what is in the box.
Well, the box program came to us as we were implementing a safe sleep project through the state of Alaska for our unit. And one of our staff discovered what Finland had been doing. And so we started looking into that. And the contents of the box, we're still building that, but it will contain things like breast pads, washcloths, burp pads, a baby snuggle wrap, and blankets, and things of that nature, pacifiers and a healthcare kit, and a book. So we're putting that together into a nice package for mothers. And the box can be used for the first few months of a baby's life. The goal is to promote safe sleep and have a safe sleep environment, because what studies have shown is that babies are safer sleeping on their backs in an environment with nothing else in it but what the baby is wrapped in, which should be kind of like a snuggle wrap. No extra blankets, no toys.
No fluffy bumper pads.
No fluffy bumper pads. And so that's the message that this is conveying, and the product will help them do that.
Well, Jason Puckett from GCI is here, and I'm going to guess that GCI is the sponsor of this, Jason. So talk a little bit about your company's involvement.
Well, we've worked with Bartlett a lot in the past, and so when they needed a little bit of help with storage, because you know having to store all this stuff, it takes a big area. So we have our warehouse over by Costco, and so they reached out to us, asked for some help, and we donated a big chunk of our warehouse so we can help store the boxes and some of the materials for them.
True collaboration there.
Exactly. And also we're on our first Friday event that we're having on the 7th, we're going to have them come in, and they're going to feature these boxes and be able to show them to the public.
Oh, good idea. Where will that happen?
That's at our downtown location at 118 Seward.
So people can see what actually the baby box is about, how it's constructed, and what comes in it then.
Yes.
So, Christina, you mentioned we have a gala every year for the foundation. Talk about that event and when you're expecting that to happen, because it's what will support the purchase of the baby boxes for the families.
Correct. So that's going to be held Saturday, October 3rd at the Elizabeth Protovich Hall. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on. It's going to be amazing. I'm kind of reading my notes here. Sorry.
Is it food and dancing?
It is a food and dancing. What else would there be? We have the Thunder Mountain Big Band playing there, and there'll be live and silent auctions. Taku Smokeries is generously donating the seafood for it this year. It's traditionally called the Seafood Gala. The main project, again, is the baby boxes, but there's lots of other great things to donate money to and just to the foundation in general.
What does the foundation do? We're all familiar with Bartlett Regional Hospital. What is a foundation, and how is it associated with what happens at our regional hospital here?
So the mission of the foundation is to basically support the hospital and fund special projects and anything the hospital might need outside of their budget. Because it's a city hospital, they're not eligible for grants and other things other hospitals might be eligible for. So we kind of fill that gap and help fund. Last year at our gala, we funded CCU beds that are really cool.
And that is a critical care unit bed?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Are you saying Bartlett didn't have that, or?
We just got them really cool, updated, fancy ones.
What makes them cool? Give us an idea.
They can bring you from laying down to standing, which is one of the physical things.
I might need one of those at home. That's possible.
And it monitors your body. I mean, it's a really cool thing.
What are some of the other things that the foundation has funded? If you could give us a couple more examples.
One of the great projects is the Bartlett House, which is a living / hotel space that provides long-term patients places to stay while they're at the hospital, especially some of our crews, patients that come in that are just off the ship and they have nowhere to stay. It allows them to have a nice, inexpensive place to stay while they're at the hospital. There's so much, actually. A climbing wall we did. There's always a Blue Heron gift shop, which is a nonprofit shop within the hospital that we run. And all those funds also go back into funding the hospital.
Can anybody shop at the Blue Heron gift shop?
Yes, absolutely. Everyone should come. We have local artists represented there and lots of cool gifts.
If someone wanted to know more about the Bartlett Foundation, where would they find that information, and do they need special skills if they wanted to be a part of that?
Not at all. You can go to our website, which is brhfoundation.org, and we are always looking for volunteers to help in the gift shop and at these events.
And are you the director of the foundation or a volunteer? Tell us about how it's structured.
Maria Yucatel, who is the executive director, and I am the assistant.
So there is a staff.
Just two of us, yep.
Not just volunteers, but they have some support through a staff member.
Right.
Then.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Karen, in talking about Bartlett Beginnings, do parents get some training when a baby is born about safe sleep and what the research shows about that? Because I know there's been a conversation about, for example, co-sleeping and having families sleep together. And I'm wondering how Bartlett offers information to parents once a baby arrives.
Well, we assess what their plan is, first of all. Do they have a crib or bed, accommodations for their baby? And then we do talk to them and teach them about safe sleep and, you know, give them all the information that they need to make an informed decision.
And are there families that do not have a crib or a sleeping plan for their baby in terms of a bed?
Yes, on occasion we run into that. And in fact, most recently we did get some boxes to demonstrate and see what the product is like, and we ended up giving those to families in need. So we've ordered another one so we can have it at First Friday. So it's a need in our community.
Will every family receive this, or will it be based on need?
Every family will be offered a box, and I would think that some will take it and maybe some won't.
And where would somebody have a chance to, say, look at the box? You mentioned First Friday. Jason, why don't you repeat where the box will be on display at the GCI office downtown?
Definitely. It's a 118 Seward, so it's right across from the Rookery and Shoe Fly, right on Seward. A lot of people don't know the store's there, but we're definitely there. And so we have First Friday of every month, and it's going to be from 4:30 to 6:30. You can come by and take a look at everything.
Karen, is there a website that shows the baby box construction and how that works? Or maybe it could be Googled.
Yeah, it can be Googled. Google baby box, and it will give you all sorts of information. There is a project going on in Ketchikan right now where they're just at the part of their project where they're giving the boxes to families. And I think there's another community in Alaska that also is promoting them, and then that, if they just Google it, it'll take them to a couple of companies that sell them, and they can see what Finland has done as well.
Sure. Christina, do you know about the price of a single baby box, and what is the, do you have a financial goal for the gala that you're hosting in October?
You know, I don't have a specific goal at this point. No, I don't know the exact cost of what the box is. Each box will be a little different. You might know more than that.
Yeah, I can tell you. The boxes cost about $30 each, and that includes a mattress and a mattress protector and two fitted sheets. And then the contents, of course, are separate. That's a separate price. So all in all, we're looking at the project anywhere from $30,000 for 500 boxes, so we're looking at a little more than a year's worth.
How many babies are born in Juneau each year?
We have about 400 delivered a year.
Is that a lot compared to past years, or is that an average?
That's an average, and it's been fairly consistent since I've been at Bartlett.
That's a lot of babies.
400
babies a year. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We've been talking with Karen White of the Bartlett Beginnings out at our local hospital that also serves our region, and Christina Finner, who is one of the managers of the Bartlett Foundation, which supports those things that the hospital otherwise cannot buy. Look for the foundation's gala October 3rd. The funds raised from there will support the purchase of baby boxes for families who want and need a sleeping plan for their baby. GCI is a supporter of this project. You can take a look at a baby box on August 7th. That is what we call the First Friday, and GCI is located at 118 Seward Street. You can stop by there 4:30 to 6:30 on August 7th. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate what you do for our community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.